All right, let's head over to the Zoom studio. Warren Martin, Kansas Strong with us, the Oil and Gas Resource Board. I almost tried to put a couple words together and said oil and geese, which was...
Yeah, we don't do anything with geese. We don't do... We tried herding geese at one point in time, and we found that the oil industry was a much more profitable industry.
You know, Ducks Unlimited, they never really got into the goose market, did they? Which is, you know, Christmas goose, there's a whole market there. And actually, in China, they use geese in some parks instead of dogs. And a goose is a very aggressive animal. So when I read how law enforcement was using it, and I'm like going, that's brilliant, absolutely brilliant. But Warren Strong is our guest. Kansas Strong is the name of the organization, the Kansas Oil and Gas Resource Board. And first of all, just a quick elevator pitch, maybe a couple floors of what Kansas Strong does on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. So Kansas Strong is a nonprofit organization dedicated to educating the people of Kansas about the oil and gas industry. Our job is to teach people what we do, how we do it, why it's important to you, and why it matters for our future. And so we do that through a variety of ways. We do that through education, going into schools, doing presentations, helping teachers explain to students the importance of the oil and gas industry in their current lives. We do that through doing that in the communities, going into Lions Clubs, Rotaries, Kiwanis, all those social clubs, and doing presentations there as well. And we also do it through advertising, traditional advertising, marketing, sponsorships of events. We sponsor most of the major universities here in the state, and we utilize those opportunities just to get the word out about how important oil and gas is here in Kansas. We produce oil here in Kansas in 89 out of the 105 counties, and so it is a vital part of our industry here. We're consistently ranked in the top industries in the state. And so, and provide on average, the University of Kansas did a study a few years ago that showed that if you looked at the jobs that were the majority of their job was dependent upon the oil and gas industry, we provide about 118,000 jobs here in the state. So it's a significant part of Kansas. And like a lot of states, where oil and gas is being produced in the state is not where the major voting blocks are. Where the major voting blocks are, there's really no oil or gas production that takes place in those areas. So education is a key to helping the entire state understand that while it may not be being produced in your area, it's still a vital part of our economic future here as the state of Kansas.
One of the reasons I believe Kansas is a very important part of the conversation and should always have a seat at the table is not because of the amount of oil production the state does, which is generally around 10th. I think you're 11th now. Maybe you've been 9th in the last, I don't know, a couple of years, whatever. It's more about how many independent, I guess, producers and small businesses that really you have. That's what makes Kansas so unique, is that 80 to 85%, I think, is the number you've told me in the past. But when I take a look at what that represents, you mentioned the amount of jobs that come from oil and gas. I've always said for years that that's a small number, because I'm technically in the media business. So I don't even, my company does not register oil and gas. The name of the company is The Crude Life. You can't get any more in your face of an oil and gas name than that, but we're not counted in those stats.
Right.
And so have you ever taken a look at least Kansas, what the, you know, second or third or fourth direct impact is? Because you are a little bit different, you know, where you go down to the Permian Basin or Williston, North Dakota, or some areas of Oklahoma, literally the whole town is oil and gas, meaning every flower shop, every coffee shop, if the oil and gas activity wasn't there, they'd be gone. And in the Permian, that's true with the university system. That's true with every office park there, because it's literally a desert. It's like Saudi Arabia here in, you know, the United States. So have you ever really taken a look at the independent contractors, the small businesses, in addition or in combination with those independent producers?
So that's where that study from the University of Kansas comes in. So here in Kansas, directly in the oil and gas industry. So if you just look up oil and gas stats, people who work in the oil and gas industry directly, the number is about 11,414 people that are actually working for an oil company. The University of Kansas took that a step further, and they looked at, okay, what other jobs is the vast majority, over 50% of that job, directly dependent upon the oil and gas industry here in the state of Kansas? And that's where they came up with the number 118,000 jobs here in the state of Kansas that are directly dependent upon the oil and gas industry. You can extrapolate beyond that, and I don't know what that number would be, but it'd be a far larger number than four, the jobs that would be impacted by the oil and gas industry, the communities, especially in Western Kansas, that would dry up, the economic impact that would hit from the loss of the oil and gas industry throughout the state, how it would impact other jobs. There's certainly no doubt that there are other jobs that would be lost, and there are other jobs that, if not lost, would certainly be diminished by the lack of oil and gas activity that is taking place here in the state. So I think it's important that, you know, while I don't have that exact number, to know that 11,414 people work in the oil and gas industry here in the state directly. 118,000 jobs are directly dependent upon the oil and gas industry. And like you said, we only have one major oil company that works here in the state. On the production side, we have a lot of pipelines, we have refineries, midstream, downstream. We have a lot of those consumers that are made, that are big oil companies that are here. But on the production side of it, we only have one major oil company that does any real production here in the state. The rest of the state are those independent producers that are out there that are producing that oil, which really makes Kansas a battleground state, especially when it comes to the methane issues that we're talking about. In the oil industry right now, it's a major, you can't go anywhere without talking about the methane regulations, the Chevron doctrine, all of those things. Kansas is going to be the battlefield, because what those methane regulations potentially propose to do is add a significant cost on the production side of things. And being a marginal well community, where we, most of our wells, that average well here in Kansas produces 2.5 barrels a day. The average oil company in Kansas has 3 employees. So we're very much those marginal well producers. Those are the ones who are going to get hurt most and are most likely to be pushed out of the industry if the methane regulations go into full force. So Kansas is a very important state in what's going to happen in the oil and gas industry over the next 5 years, because it is going to be a battleground state, when, especially when it comes to those methane regulations. And how does our industry survive? Because if we lose the oil and gas industry here in Kansas, it is definitely going to negatively impact our state.
When we take a look at the last 4 years, the changes that have happened, the word energy transition has come out. And in our previous conversation, we mentioned how that's a little Orwellian, because transitioning is you actually retire something and you start doing something else. You retire the Ford, now you're driving a Chevy, whatever the case is. So whether it's from a linguistics or a just wordplay marketing, if you will, that's a huge part of what's going on. There's also this carbon movement, where a lot of oil and gas companies became energy companies, and now they're carbon management companies, where Occidental actually, I believe, is now called a carbon management company. Shell's flirting with changing their name too. And I saw this in the media, you know, first they were newspapers, and then they were print, and now, and then they were multimedia, and now they're just content companies, you know. So there's a change, and there's paradigm shifts to say this has happened before. When you talk about Kansas, with all the amount of small businesses and the independents, you've got one major producer there. I'm not sure if that major producer is tied to the carbon project that's going on with the state or not, but talk to me about some of the evolutions that you are seeing, whether it's how just the language is changing and that's what's really changing the industry, or whether, you know, the companies are looking more towards biomass, or they're looking more towards carbon storage, because in some cases, a lot of oil and gas companies are busy capping orphan wells, capping abandoned wells. Yeah, that keeps you busy for a little bit, but once that well is capped, that's it. The business is done. So now you got to go find new business. So some of this is a band-aid. Some of it's actually carving a new path, if you will. And one of the roads, boy, it's a windy, confusing, and then you end up right back where you started again. So talk to me a little bit about those observations and how Kansas is dealing with some of them. Is there anyone that's maybe standing out more than the other? You understand my question. So yeah, I'll let you just kind of, go ahead. So what's your biggest challenge and what are some of the other areas? Yeah.
Well, there's a lot in that question that you just asked.
I know, that was the problem. So there's too much.
I'll start with the abandoned wells. On the abandoned wells front, we've made a lot of progress. When I first started this job about 8 years ago, I came in and I had a producer that met me at the door that met him for the first time. And he asked me how I was doing. I said, just plugging away. And he quickly responded and said, we don't say that in this industry. But over the past couple of years, we do say it, and we say it a lot, plugging away. Here in Kansas, we're one of the oldest oil and gas fields in the country. We have many wells that date back over 100 years. But with that, you're going back to a time in technology where we really had no way of finding oil and gas underneath the ground in a realistic geological way. And so back over 100 years ago, people here in Kansas would just go out and drill holes and just pop holes in the ground. In fact, in 1914, the average was if you were to go and drill 100 wells, you could expect 4 of those wells to come in. That's 100 holes that you're putting in the ground, but only 4 of them are coming in. Of course, back then, the regulations were not nearly what they are today. We weren't really as concerned or aware of environmental issues like we are today. So what we had here in Kansas and have here in Kansas is we have a scenario where you have legacy wells that are 80, 100 years old that have been drilled into the ground but have never been properly plugged. They're labeled as orphaned or abandoned wells on the register. And they're really a problem. They're a problem for people who want to buy a lease because they don't want to take on the obligation of these abandoned wells that are on that lease. They're a problem for property owners who want to buy property but have an abandoned well on that property. And so with the federal government and the state have been a part of this program for the past 2 years to really go out and plug a vast number of those abandoned wells and get those taken care of and get them off of the books. And that's been a very big thing for us. So where plugging a well is generally not a good thing in the industry, it is in this case because we're getting rid of all these legacy wells that no one has responsibility for because those companies are long, long gone. And it gets them off the board to where the landowners can do what they want with the property, where people can take out leases without having to worry about the obligation of taking on those orphaned wells as well. So that's been a really, really good thing. In the oil industry, as you know, diversification has always been the key. It's a boom and bust economy. Companies are always looking to diversify. It's really the majors that are diversifying towards biofuels, towards alternative forms of energy, towards carbon capture. That really has been much more of the realm of the big oil companies rather than the small oil companies. Small oil companies here in Kansas, they tend to invest more in other industries, whether it be sports gyms, whether it be real estate, whether it be whatever companies that are out there, they make those investments in there to where when the oil industry has its bust cycle, they have a different industry that they can rely on for their income. And that's where a lot of their diversification takes place. With that being said, there's been a big movement here in Kansas over the past 4 years to really capture. We got a great geology for the carbon capture efforts that are taking place. And so we have some older fields that are being utilized now for carbon capture. We do have a few companies that have invested and become a part and been involved in ethanol production from Nebraska down through Kansas into northern Texas. And part of that ethane production is there's a need for the carbon capture. What do you do with the carbon that you capture through the ethane production? And so there's really been a good partnership between ethanol and the oil industry here in the state to really kind of begin this process of carbon capture here in the state. And I think that that's been a big move that's been taking place. More than anything else, I think that what you're seeing here in Kansas is you're seeing companies that are becoming leaner, becoming meaner, and in taking care of their financial perspective, because it's always been kind of the rule of thumb. If the price of the barrel is above $75, then we're good to go. Let's go explore, let's go discover, move forward. That really hasn't been the case over the past 4 years. Hadn't been the case because the price has been up over $75 a barrel. But at the same time, your cost of steel, your cost of transportation, your even the ability to get the parts that you need to go out and do exploration and production have been so stifling that when you work on those smaller margins, even with the price where it's at, it's a lot harder to make a play and to put a team out in the field to do that exploration and make a profit off of it. So it's a little bit more risky. That's kind of dampened a little bit comeback after the pandemic. We are coming back. We are getting our production back up. We are getting more rigs in the field, but it's been a little slow coming back, predominantly because of that cost of supplies, the cost of labor, and the inability to get the supplies that you need. And so, you know, that's what we really need. We really need to focus on here in Kansas is a little bit of a change in those arenas.
Are you seeing a connection with energy, ag, and carbon? I'm seeing this like trinity happening where energy, ag, and carbon are really starting to become attached a lot more than in the past. I mean, they always have been. I mean, honestly, yeah. whether you want to call it, you know, fertilizers or crop rotation or whatever the case is, you know, you're talking about really some carbon management at the end of the day, using the energy industry and agriculture. Now it just seems like, I don't know if it's technology or if it's AI or if it's different policy or what, but it just seems, at least in North Dakota, Iowa, two ethanol states and ag states, certainly seems that they're connecting up pretty good. And then you just mentioned the ethanol and oil and gas connection. It just made me wonder a little bit, is that happening in Kansas? Are you seeing more of a partnership and a connection than in the previous decades?
Yeah, I don't know how much more of a connection it is, but as an opportunity. And I think it has more to do with opportunity than it does with connection. The oil and gas producers, they need the farmers and ranchers to be able to access their land to be able to produce their oil. In Kansas, you'll find a lot of farmers and ranchers out here that will tell you we need the oil and gas industry because that's the only way through the lean years that our family's been able to make it through and hold on to the family farm and be able to keep going in production. So there's always been somewhat of that relationship, but there's also been some tension in that relationship because there's, like any other business, there's negotiations that take place and everybody's trying to get the better price and get a good deal on what they're doing. Introduce into that the carbon capture, and especially with carbon capture being backed to some degree by the federal government and dollars coming from the federal government, it really just creates an opportunity for ag, for energy to saddle up with carbon to try and take advantage of those to fix one problem where it helps out my company if I can handle the carbon. It helps out their company if they can get rid of the carbon, and you put those things together. So I think it's more of an opportunity, just a situation of opportunity, more so than, if in a free market world without government dollars coming in, would we be in the same place? I don't think so. I think that we would not be anywhere close on the carbon capture scene as what we are with the federal dollars coming in for it.
So when you take a look at the federal dollars coming in, who are they going to? So in North Dakota, it's mostly out of state big companies. And the North Dakota companies, if they benefit, well, okay, maybe. You know, it depends on what trickles down, if you will. But we're in a global marketplace now. I mean, so when we talk about keeping up with the Joneses, it's like keeping up with the Sheiks now for some people because it's a global marketplace. Yeah. I got to have a better yacht than they have. So the trickle-down economics might not get to that independent guy with three employees and that sort of thing. How is the smaller guy handling some of these changes? Are they being able to get anything in the carbon industry? Because it's very controlled.
We got a few producers that are involved in carbon capture that, you know, they have leases that are identifiable and usable for that. And so I think that, you know, when you're looking at the carbon capture, we don't have a lot of producers that are at play in that. Some of our larger producers that are here in the state, a couple of those are involved in it. And I think the trickle down, you know, most of the money is, like you say, it's going to major corporations that are involved in the carbon capture side of it. But those corporations, they still have to pay for the lease. They still have to pay for, you know, just like a producer would, they're paying the producer for to lease that strata to be able to put that carbon in there. You got the flow down that's going to the seismic companies and being able to shoot seismic. And on carbon capture right now, you have to shoot seismic on a carbon capture site every 2 years. So that's a boom for the seismic industry that's taking place as well here in Kansas. And so I think that, you know, yes, is it direct payments to? No. You know, oil and gas producers here in Kansas, there's no subsidies that come in. What people call subsidies are traditional tax credits that everybody gets to take on their tax returns. There's no money going from the federal government to producers here in Kansas. But at the same time, there is a trickle down impact where you got these major companies that are still having to go through the steps of leasing the land, of shooting the land, and installing in installing the wells to be able to capture that carbon. So there is a trickle down, not quite as much as probably a lot of producers would like to see, but on fields that, you know, have dried up, on fields that are no longer viable, it's a good way to utilize that land in a good way.
What's your number one question you get from people out and about? So when you're, whether at a bridge club or you're at a, you know, conference where there's a couple thousand people, is there from the audience or from an individual, is there anyone that stands out, a question or two that is either a really good one that you think people should know, or it's kind of a reoccurring one that seems to get asked everywhere you go?
Yeah, probably the number one question I'm asked all the time is everywhere I go is, you know, when are we going to run out of oil? And that's the biggest issue that's brought up on a regular basis. People, yeah, but what happens when we run out? It's phrased in different ways. You know, when are we going to run out of oil? What happens when we run out of oil? Aren't we close to running out of oil? You know, and that really comes down to legal. Again, when we talked to last time, we talked about terminology, and this is again where terminology comes into play. It really comes down to a legal definition. If you go back to the Obama administration changed the legal definition of a proven oil reserve and made it a legal term to try and curb how much money oil companies could borrow based on the reserves that they had found in order to go and produce new reserves. So you go out and you find a big field, and you'd have your big play at this big field, and you'd say there's this much oil in that field, and then you go borrow against that oil to go try and find other fields. And so as a way to kind of curb that action, the Obama administration changed the legal definition of a proven oil reserve, that a proven oil reserve is only the amount of oil that's in the ground that you can extract from the ground, and 90% of that you can make a profit off of. You have to be able to get 90% of it up to make a profit off of it for it to be counted as a proven oil reserve. So what does that do? That significantly reduces the amount of oil that people talk about being on the planet, because you got your proven oil reserve, your probable oil reserve, and your known oil reserve. And the three of those are different. And so when you look at that known oil reserve that's out there, you know, the best estimates that I've seen is that at current consumption levels, we have almost 300 years of oil that is viable and usable. Now, some of that, the oil price would have to go up significantly to make it viable to get it out of the ground and still make a profit up. The, you know, we have wells here in eastern Kansas that are in tighter formations where we're having to use water flood. And we know that we're leaving half or more of the oil in the ground when we're plugging in some of those wells because it costs too much to get it out of the ground. But if the price of oil goes up, all of a sudden that oil is now viable again. So I think that the biggest thing that I try and educate people on is that when you go on the internet and you say, how much oil do we have? When will we run out of oil? All of those figures that are out there are generally slanted by the proven oil reserves, which is very different than known oil on the planet. And so I think that is a major learning curve that people have to really understand in order to realize that we're not about to run out of oil. We're not facing an immediate crisis where we're not going to have, our kids aren't going to have energy or our grandkids aren't going to have energy. And that kind of takes that pressure off of it and really lets us focus in on the other issues, which are much more important.
I never knew that about the oil reserves and that sort of thing with the Obama administration. I knew that you had to actually prove a well. So you had to drill it, prove there was oil there, then you could cap it and you have 20, 25 years to go back and drill it again, depending on the price. And so when there's $100 oil, it was a drilling bonanza, but then it turned off because, again, some of the wells, it's $90, it's $100, right. It's $110. In today's economy, you know, $50 is probably $100 when you're talking about oil prices for all those supply chain inflationary cost of goods, wages, whatever. There's so many changes that have happened in the marketplace over the past 5 to 10 years that we were doing stories in 2020. You know, is $50 oil the new $100 oil? Just to get people to go through the exercise of, oh yeah, we should probably take a look at the inflation in the last year that's gone up. We should take a look at these things. Natural gas. Did an interview yesterday with Bettering Human Lives Foundation. They're a nonprofit started by Liberty Energy. And they're one of their missions is traveling to Africa and getting people on clean cooking. So instead of using wood, and I guess in some places they use, you know, feces dung, you know, cow dung, whatever, elephant dung. So getting people off of those high carcinogenic fires, if you will, you know, campfires and that sort of thing, to a propane or a liquid propane. Where's Kansas at? I know the western side of Kansas is pretty good with natural gas. Is the state accepting it? Are the feds coming in? You mentioned the Chevron Doctrine. Is that going to impact how Kansas moves ahead in the natural gas world? Talk to me a little bit about clean cooking with natural gas and where you're at with that.
Yeah. So I'll go do a little bit of history on myself. And, you know, I've before I got into the oil and gas industry, I worked in ministry and I worked in 28 countries around the world. Several of those countries, Pakistan, for example, Pakistan was a great example of exactly what you're talking about. Every morning I'd wake up. It's an energy deprived country. There's very little energy that is available to the citizens that are there, especially when I was there in the late 1990s. Very little energy that was available. And so every morning I would get up and I would go down to the butcher shop. And I'd go down to the butcher shop. You didn't pick out your slices of meat. I'd literally pick out 10 chickens and a goat, and they would slaughter those animals right there in front of me. And while they were slaughtering them, I would go down to the ice house to get our block of ice that we'd use because there's no refrigeration in Pakistan because they are very limited on energy. So I'd get my ice block, and then we'd load it up onto a cart that was pulled by a water buffalo. As we were walking back towards the butcher shop to pick up what should be our processed meat at this point, were walking back across town, these kids would follow in behind this cart. And what they were doing is they were waiting for this water buffalo to defecate on the ground. And when it would defecate on the ground, they would scramble and race to rip grass up off the side of the road, run to the cow paddy or the water buffalo paddy to see who could pick it up first. They'd pick it up and they would mix the straw in with the dung. And they would, as they walked home, they would flatten that out, slap it on the south side of their house, and allow it to stay on the south side of their house and dry in the sun until it dried enough that it started peeling off the wall. When it got to that point, that's when it was good to take it in and utilize it in their for their cooking, for their heating in their homes, and that was their energy. Those kids have absolutely zero chance to compete with my kids and my grandkids who are in school, who are learning technology, they're learning math, math and reading and sciences and all of those things. These kids are having to go out every day and collect energy for their family. So that's a very dramatic sequence of events for any child to begin with to be able to try and compete on the world stage. Now, the problem is that the United Nations and other governmental organizations, but predominantly the United Nations, they have programs to provide additional energy to third world nations. However, all of their policies are built around it has to be the right kind of energy. So it has to be either solar or it has to be wind that they're putting into these countries. And so what you've seen in the past few years is you've seen China that has really taken advantage of that. And China has gone around the world and they went to Pakistan. And they went to Pakistan and they said, we'll give you electric coal-burning electric plants if you'll give us access to build a pipeline from Western China down to Karachi. And they exchanged those plants for the pipeline. And they're doing the same thing in countries all over the world, exchanging coal-burning plants for precious minerals, exchanging coal-burning plants for airports. And that's how they're gaining a lot of access around the world. The United States is way behind, and we're losing a lot of our world ability to impact government relations around the world because we are continuing to go through the United Nations and insist on that we're only going to give you energy if it's the right kind of energy. So I have not heard about this company, so I'm excited that they're actually going out and doing what needs to be done, because any form of modern energy, any form, even coal, is better than burning wood or cow dung in order to cook your meals. The carcinogens that come from that, the what's in the air, anything is better than that. Everybody should be on board with getting people the best alternative form of energy that they can possibly get. When I say alternative, I mean alternative to traditional biofuels, because any form of fuel besides a traditional biofuel is better for the environment. It's better for all of us. It's certainly better for the people that are utilizing it. Coming back to Kansas, the Hugoton field has historically been the largest natural gas field in the world. While we don't produce as much natural gas as we used to, that field has been in production for, it's also one of the longest producing natural gas fields in the world. And so every year we produce a little bit less gas than we did the year before. It is still a significant contributor to the world, to the United States, to our natural gas production. And it's also becoming a significant contributor to the helium market, as we have a helium plant that's extracting helium out of the natural gas that's coming from parts of the Hugoton field. So that is a significant part of the oil and gas industry here in Kansas. But like I say, you know, it's really not a place where we're going to grow our natural gas capacity. More so, it's trying to keep it stable and keep it going as long as we possibly can.
It's interesting about the natural gas is, I it's one of my frustrating conversations with people, because a lot of people are throw the baby out with the bathwater. So no natural gas, no oil. And I always remind people that the majority of oil that we find in the ocean today, and at one time when it first started, is from seepage. It's coming out of the ground, whether you like it or not. Yeah. So should we just like leave it there, or should we do something with it because it's coming out. And natural gas is like that. You mentioned you've had that big, giant natural gas field. Is that kind of like Grand Junction, where it's just it's like going to keep coming no matter what? It almost seems like there's certain pockets where the cavities will fill back up with gas, and there's like a constant stream of almost like a spring, you know, with water. There's always water. It comes out of a spring,
right,
as long as the aquifer is there. And is that what Kansas is like? Is that it's just always been there and it's always going to produce? Or do they have an estimate, like if there's 30 more years and it should be dry? Is there anything like that?
I don't know of an estimate off the top of my head. I'm sure someone out there has that estimate. It is a diminishing field, where, you know, you can look historically where what we used to produce to what we produce now.
Sure.
You know, every well goes through that cycle where you have your, when you first put it in, you have your flood of oil that comes, and then it kind of stables off to a consistent level of production. And then over time, that level of production eventually begins to drop off at every single well, a little by little. And we have the same thing in the Hugoton field. When you look across wells across the board, where there was a huge boom, there's lots of the pressure, there's lots of discovery, it's easy to get out. And now you stabilize for a long time, and now we're in that gradual diminish. And so I don't know how many years that is. I know we still have a lot of years left in the natural gas production in that side of the state. But again, it's not something that's going to add to our, which is right now, I think is what I'm trying to help people understand, is it's important for us to not understand, you know, how do we provide the energy that we need today? It's really important for us to understand that we're going to add 1.7 billion people to the planet between now and 2050. You've got all of these people around the world that are 60% of the population of the world that is energy deprived, meaning they don't have access to the energy that they want. And so it's not just a question of how are we going to supply the energy we need today. The real question is how are we going to increase our energy to be able to supply the demand that's going to be coming over the next 30 years? And that is really what we should be talking about. Unfortunately, it's not what we're talking about, because everyone's talking about energy transition. And I'm really advocating for, we need to be talking about our energy future, and we really need to be focused on how are we going to grow that energy. And we can grow that energy two ways: through production of new energy, whether that's oil, natural gas, coal, nuclear, whatever it is. We're going to have to produce more energy. And the second aspect of that, which is the fastest growing energy category right now, which is conservation of energy, or what's the word I'm looking for? Energy efficiency. There we go. Energy efficiency is the fastest growing energy sector in the world. And we can grow our energy in two ways: by being more efficient and by producing more. And it's going to take both of those to be able to get where we need to be by 2050.
Energy future, I think helium would be in there. That's an interesting, we mentioned this before in the past. And I know there's a small market in the balloon industry, but I believe it, there might be one in the Space Force industry, because when you get into outer space, xenon and some of these gases that are light, they can propel a rocket where there's no gravity. I'm not sure what kind of helium market is out there, but are there anything in terms of future use, and is the current use beyond balloons?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. In fact, I doubt any of the helium that they're extracting right now from the natural gas comes from or goes to inflating balloons. It goes to more than just hot air. Most of the helium that's being extracted from here in Kansas is actually going into the medical field and utilized in medical procedures, medical equipment. And I'm not exactly sure how that happens, but that's where it's being used mostly, is in the medical field. And so helium is a prime market right now, because it is in short supply. And so this extraction is a big deal, and it's a big part of especially for royalty owners and for producers that are able to get the payout from extracting this helium. So there is a good market that is there that goes way beyond balloons.
Is your gas wet or dry in Kansas? Would it be more wet or more dry, I guess, the natural gas?
Well, we have a good diversity that takes place here because we go all the way from purely natural gas wells to pure oil wells to a combination of oil and natural gas wells. So we got a pretty good mixture that goes across the state.
Okay. I know in some of them you can get, you know, pentane, butane, methane, these different things, I guess. Which brings us to the Chevron doctrine, and then we'll get into some movie reviews. Whenever these Supreme Court decisions happen, I immediately go into my Libra mind and kind of have, you know, mixed reactions. I'm an entrepreneur. And so for me, less regulations, less government is generally on the top of my list. But I also know that that does benefit a lot of the bigger companies much more than me. So that's the quickest road to fascism, if you will. Yeah. But at the same time, that gives the small business owners an opportunity, which they didn't have before. Yeah. And so when you have more regulations, I always tell people, as a small business owner, it's actually harder for the small business owner to maneuver because we have to now wait in line for them to get down with the big boys, and then they'll eventually get to us. So our quick and nimbleness is like gone. Yeah. So when they take away regulations, it makes us quicker than the big companies. Yeah, the big companies got more of a thump and a stroke, but we're quick again, and we can outmaneuver, and we might be able to attract them and get a contract to do some research project or go help them there, go do this. So how are you looking at the Chevron doctrine? Is this something that is going to help oil and gas? Is it going to help your small producers? Is it only going to help the big producers? Combination of all the above. Have you had a chance to process? Talk to me about the Chevron.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot that's unknown about that, whether it's going to help or not. It does open the door for the potentiality of help. I will say that the oil and gas producers that are here in the state of Kansas, they'll be the first ones to tell you that we need regulation in our industry. If you look in our past, you look at our history, you can see the obvious need for regulation because we want people to do it the right way. We want people to take care of our state. We want people to take care of the land, take care of the environment. We want them to do it the right way. However, you also have situations where the government over-regulates an industry. And you have to keep in mind, every time you pass a regulation, you increase the cost for that business. Because there are no regulations that can be monitored without somebody paying something. And so every regulation increases the cost of doing business. And so it's really the over-regulation of the industry that is of major concern for the oil and gas producer. The problem with the Chevron doctrine is when 40 years ago, the Chevron doctrine was put in place, it basically established that when you have a producer and the state agency that comes up with the regulations that are in conflict with each other and they bring it to court, that the court has to give deference to the regulators that came up with the regulations. Well, that pretty much gives them a win. It removes the judge from making a decision one way or the other because he or she has to give deference. To the regulators. So the overturning of the Chevron doctrine basically goes back 40 years and says, okay, all of those cases that we've looked at that where we gave deference to the regulators going forward, now all of those are in a position where they can be brought back up and brought back to the scenario. And instead of giving deference to the regulators who made the rules, it really brings that third branch of government in because you had the legislature that wrote the law, you had the regulators that interpreted the law and made the regulations. But up until now, there really hasn't been that third arm, which is the judiciary. in the judiciary now, because they don't have to give deference to the Chevron doctrine, they can now adjudicate every one of those regulatory issues based on fairness between the two parties, taking each party's side equally into account to make those decisions. So it's not an issue of producers don't want regulations. We don't want over-regulation. We want the regulations because we don't want bad actors in our industry. But this gives us, brings back to the table the ability for us to go to the judicial branch and have that arbitrated in a fair way that doesn't give favor to the regulators who wrote the regulations that we're challenging. And so where it's going to go from here, it's really going to come down to companies that are able to challenge regulatory action, and then what the judges decide. And they could decide in our favor, they could decide against us. But, you know, so the outcome, we don't know what it's going to be, but it is a good thing that now we have all three branches of government involved. You have the legislature that created the law, the regulators who interpreted it and put the regulations in through the executive branch, and now you have the judiciary back on the table that can adjudicate fairly between the producer and the regulators. And that's a good thing.
Do you see it helping states like Oklahoma, Texas, Alaska?
I see it potentially helping a lot of people and a lot of different industries. You know, one of the major challenges to the Chevron doctrine didn't come from oil and gas producing. It came from offshore fishing, and new regulations that were put in place for offshore fishing, where the regulators put into place regulations that they had to be monitored, and the whoever was the captain of the boat was, that captain had to provide space for a monitor to come on the ship, feed them, take care of them, take care of their upkeep, and pay for all of that themselves for them to monitor their own activity. That'd be like you paying a cop to watch you drive so that you don't speed. I mean, it just makes no sense that you have to pay for that cop personally and have him follow you around and make sure you don't speed. That's what happened here. And that was one of the major challenges to the Chevron doctrine that went forward. And so it's not just the oil and gas industry. It's regulations across the board in all different kinds of industries. But definitely I see it as opening the door for opportunities for oil and gas companies to be able to challenge some of these burdensome regulations, especially in a state like ours, which is a marginal well state, where there are regulations that we have to follow that really don't apply to a marginal well. They apply to larger wells. And so that, you know, that gives us the option now to be able to go back to court and challenge those regulations and whether they're fair and practical.
There was a cattle rustling. I can't remember exactly. I just remember that it kept being referred to as cattle rustling up in North Dakota about 10 years ago. And I remember talking about it for at least a week on the radio, because it was a great example of how the government could use it to track each head of cow, right? So there was a push by some agencies where through climate change, you had to count every head of cattle, every sheep, and they were going to force all these farmers to make all these upgrades with their technology software. And as well, they were bringing in the drones. I'm going, oh my goodness, they're going to make all these farmers now invest in drones so it can count the sheep every day at the end of the day. And you have these people in Washington dictating these farmers how to run their operations more efficiently and all these different things. And it's interesting, it came from the fishing industry, which would be very close to the agriculture industry just out at the sea. But it's along those same lines of, you have an agency basically saying, we're going to change your business plan for you. I hope you don't mind. And the only thing I can come close to is kosher. You've got a spiritual faith-based background as I do, where you know, people forget that Heinz ketchup employs a rabbi right there to make sure that everything's okay with the ketchup, so they can have that little U seal on the back for I forget what it stands for, but that's through a religious type of a consumer customer base. This is through a regulation to where they're putting politics into science and trying to use that as their means to an end where before they're using spirituality and a religious synagogue, a type of a structure. That's the closest analogy I've made in my head to what was happening before. Is there anybody within your organization? Excuse me. Is there anybody within your organization that has complained or reached out because of the overturning? You've got a lot of smaller producers that were probably going to be in line for some of these new methane tracking regulations where you have to have a drone go over every day and check every nook and cranny. A lot of people think that's crazy talk, but it's been rolling out in other areas and things along those lines. So have you had any feedback with your customer base?
So here in Kansas, I think our first stab the first stab I know of, there may be independent producers out there that are doing things that I don't know about and challenges I don't know about. But really, the first stab is through ECOGA and Cayoga, the Eastern Kansas Oil and Gas Association and the Kansas Independent Oil and Gas Association, who have joined with other states and other organizations to challenge the federal government's methane regulations. And so that's in a court, ongoing court case that's taking place right now. And so I kind of anticipate that most producers are going to sit back and wait to see how that plays out. I think a lot of producers are sitting back waiting to see how that plays out and how the election plays out before they, you know, take any additional action, because it certainly would be, you know, what we're looking for is just a fair audience to be able to hear our case. And the fact that, you know, we've had studies that have shown that marginal wells produce little to no methane at all. So, you know, where's the justification for all of the monitoring equipment that the methane regulations are going to require these producers to put on every single well, every single pipeline, every single tank battery, every single exchange that takes place? And so, you know, I think a lot of people are going to wait and see how that court case plays out and where it goes from there. And then I think you'll see a lot of other challenges after that, if it doesn't play out the way that the producers hope it will.
I brought up that long explanation about the agriculture industry being impacted right away. And then of course the fishing industry. So you can see how it bleeds into other industries, but I actually think the Chevron doctrine is going to impact the technology industry more than anything, because there were a lot of companies invested into technology based on the fact a lot of these companies were going to have to do the individual RFID tracking and all these different types of methane tracking and inventory and et cetera, to where now that might not be the case. And so they might have ability to reinvest or invest in other areas. You mentioned some carbon opportunities that might be available for different outfits. So I think the technology industry might get impacted the most from the Chevron doctrine, because it's going to allow people to challenge some of these regulations that required major investments into tracking technologies. But, you know, we'll have to see how it goes. I did want to ask you about the political state too, because one of the changes in North Dakota is on the eastern side of the state is Fargo and Grand Forks, and I guess Wahpeton to some degree. Wahpeton is the trade school. Well, the University of North Dakota is in Grand Forks. And that's where the Air Force base is. The North Dakota State University is in Fargo. That's the largest city right on the border, directly in the middle of the state and the Minnesota border. Wahpeton is a small, like I say, that's a smaller trade school, but it is a feeder program to the Air Force with Boeing and Northrop Grumman being big supporters down there. North Dakota politics, although three delegates, has changed. It's more purple than red, I'll tell you that. When you take a look at the cultivation factor of youth basically being the university systems, the university systems having a liberal arts, no matter how you look at it, very liberal minded thinking. So on the east side of the state now, literally, if you go 20 miles away from the Minnesota border and draw a line from Canada to South Dakota, that's 75% of your population right there is on that eastern side. You've got Topeka and Wichita, and that's the east side last I checked. How's your politics doing over there? Because the university system seemed to be the number one cultivator for the youth. And the youth generally sticks around where they, you know, a percentage of them does. So how has your politics in Kansas been?
Yeah, I think most of the Midwestern states have kind of had that same scenario, whether you're looking at Illinois, at North Dakota, you know, and certainly here in Kansas, where we have very different regions of the state. We produce oil in 89 out of the 105 counties that are here in Kansas. But all of those 89 counties, or none of those 89 counties, are really in the northeast corner of the state. The northeast corner of the state is where most of our population is. It's where Kansas City, Kansas is. It's where Lawrence is, Topeka, Manhattan, and they're all kind of in that corner up there. So you have a situation where you have most of our population, which does tend to lean more blue than red, that lives in one corner of the state, while the rest of the state tends to lead much more to the red rather than the blue, but has a very much a lower population in those counties. So we have that kind of that same similar makeup that's here. That's why we at Kansas Strong, we spend most of our money, most of our time, and most of our effort trying to really educate people in the northeast corner of the state. They're not exposed to the oil and gas industry. They're not around it. They don't know people who work in it because it's not in that part of the state. And so it's really important that we get out and we educate those people into how important the oil and gas industry is, how it matters to their life, how they utilize it every single day. And really, you know, that's where we can begin to move the needle. Because talking out here in Wichita, talking out here in Western Kansas, most of the people out here, they know people that work in the oil and gas industry. They're around the oil and gas industry. It's around them. And so they have a little bit of a clearer understanding of that than other parts of the state.
All right, let's get into a little movie review time here as I get my coffee ready, my pour over coffee, which, by the way, the water was on propane, so we're making our coffee with propane this morning. Let's talk about Mad Max and There Will Be Blood. One of the things I found funny about Mad Max was it almost seemed like a infomercial for Peak Oil, which never happened. But it's certainly it's a fun movie to think about. You know, what would you do without oil and gas? And when you start thinking about the basic transportation on how, you know, oil becomes the new commodity. You know, we used to fight wars over salt because we wanted to preserve food, basically. So you think about how our priorities shift and how our needs as a society shift. That was my takeaway from Mad Max, was that it was a great movie, but at the same time, it almost seemed like it was a little bit of a propaganda to Peak Oil, I guess, was kind of my thought. What did you think of that movie?
Well, I think that's what they intended, and I think they failed miserably because on the one hand, you know, they started out and they start out the movie and they show basically exactly what you said, the oil wars that are taking place. And let's be honest, we have fought wars over oil, and wars have been dependent upon oil. I mean, that is one thing that makes Kansas the most historic state when it comes to World War One. During World War One, Stapleton Number One was hit in 1915. And when Stapleton Number One was hit, it started an oil boom that took place here. Between 1915 and 1919, one county in Kansas, Butler County, Kansas, where I live in El Dorado, that one county in Kansas produced 9% of the world's oil. Not 9% of Kansas, not 9% of America, 9% of the world's oil. And literally, you can look at World War One in a lot of different ways, but it came down to whichever side ran out of oil first lost. And that 9% of oil that was found in Butler County put the Allies over the top and led us to outlasting the Germans when it came to oil production and being able to fight that battle. So oil has been a part of our life for a long time, and it's been a historic part, especially when it comes to wars, when it comes to modern military innovation. You know, it's certainly part of it. And that's where the movie starts, and it kind of escalates that to where we go into a nuclear fallout and everything's destroyed. And so basically they set up the idea that this apocalypse was caused by oil, as is the idea that they're trying to throw out there. But then the rest of the movie, they basically just repeat over and over, but you can't live without it, because the entire movie revolves around people trying to find oil that's left over, trying, and you will look at what they're wearing. They're wearing shoulder pads that come from football, helmets that come from hockey. They're wearing all this stuff that was made out of oil that they're having to recycle and keep on. And so it's funny to me how so many of these apocalyptic movies, they try and show how oil is going to end the world, but every single one of them, you watch it afterwards, and all it does is show that if you want to have a cool movie, you still got to have the oil somewhere involved in the rest of the movie. And that's really what I saw from Mad Max, is that, you know, it, that oil and natural gas, we cannot come up with a way to be able to maintain the lifestyles that we have today with the products, the services, and everything else without oil. And we can't do it in reality, and we can't even do it in fantasy, because even in fantasy, everything in that movie is still dependent upon oil.
Talking about some movie reviews, if you can check out Paramount Plus, The Crude Life has a content distribution deal with them where you can get a promo code if you'd like to check it out. And one of the movies available, I know for sure, on Paramount Plus, because a lot of times, you know, in fact, it's August 1st while we're recording this, and there's a whole bunch of new ones now today, and there a bunch of ones retired yesterday. So I know The Big Lebowski is no longer on Peacock. So it's one of my favorite movies, Big Lebowski. But when I take a look at There Will Be Blood, that's generally considered in the top five of oil and gas movies. A lot of people's number one. My takeaway from There Will Be Blood was not this, you know, gregarious, ruthless, cantankerous and oil tycoon, although that is an important part of the movie, is the building of a community. That's what I saw, was the down and dirty building of a community, because there was different elements brought in, the safety factors. Yeah, they showed how some original blowouts happened and how some people... I grew up in agriculture, so I'm kind of used to that, you know, type of a thing. Where at the end of the year, did we have more people die or do we have more people live, type of a thing? Sometimes that's the way life is, especially when you're building a community. One of the things with the oil and gas industry that I always found fascinating was the introduction of the spiritual element. Because when you bring, whether it's building a railroad or it's building a community based on oil and gas, when you get a lot of guys together, they like to drink together, they like to gamble together, they like to sin together. When a preacher came around, it changed everything. You know, it and that was the one element that, whether it's the railroad or oil and gas or whatever it is, it brought in a family element to where the people naturally self-corrected themselves. They weren't forced to. They all of a sudden thought of their family, whether they had one back home or they wanted to have one. They thought about something more than just the bottom of that glass. Talk to me. That was my biggest takeaway from There Will Be Blood, actually, was it showed how you can bring different elements into a community and create a positive community. Even though the movie wasn't veered as the most positive movie, that was really my takeaway, was it showed how an oil and gas company can create a community that is thriving, that ends up being positive, that ends up doing a lot of good for other people in the end. So what was your takeaway from There Will Be Blood? And if you want to comment on my observation, feel free.
No, I think your observation is very good. my takeaway was, first of all, you have to realize that we're looking at a movie that's set in a specific time and place in history. And that time and place cannot be judged by the standards that we have today. And the time and place in which the There Will Be Blood was set, you know, the late 1800s, early 1900s, you're talking about a time in America where business was brutal. There were not the oversights, there were not the, you know, the insurances, the labor unions, there was not the OSHA, none of these regulatory practices that were in place to govern business. And so business as a whole was a very ruthless endeavor. In fact, a lot of people don't know that the very first oil and gas, or the first oil pipeline that was ever built by Rockefeller was built because of this brutalness of the business. He had that up until that point, he was producing oil, he was shipping it on trains, and those trains were going all over the East Coast. Well, the Commodore and the other train titans all got together and they're like, we're hauling all of Rockefeller's oil and he's making a killing off of us, so let's stick it to him. Let's all raise our price and stick it to Rockefeller so that we can make more money and we'll diminish his assets. Well, Rockefeller just refuses to play ball with them. So what does he do? He starts building a pipeline to get his oil from his refinery down to a barge so that he can ship them by water instead of shipping them by rail. And so that's the setting in which There Will Be Blood is set, where business as a whole was a very ruthless endeavor. And the spiritual aspect that you're talking about coming into it, that was really the only governing factor during that period of time that governed business practice, is when a moral perspective could be brought into that business and enterprise so that people did act better, so that bosses acted better, employees acted better, other people acted better. And that was really the only governance over business practices back in those days, besides directly illegal activity. That was really the only governance. And so I think when you look at There Will Be Blood, you can't look at it from the lens of where we are today and the way business is done today. You have to look at it through that perspective of how business was done during that period of time. And you see a really extraordinary event. You also see how far the oil and gas industry has come from then until now. You know, for instance, when Rockefeller first started pulling oil out of the ground, what they generally just threw the gasoline away. They just washed the gasoline away because they had no idea what to do with it. It was too volatile. All they wanted was the kerosene. And now we use every molecule that comes in a barrel of oil to where there's no waste. There's no environmental danger from, you know, stuff like that being disposed of in an appropriate way. So the industry has come a very, very long ways, but it started out and it was rough. It was tough. And it was, you know, not exactly the cleanest and most environmentally friendly industry at that point in time. But I think there's another lesson that goes with that. And that's if you're looking at that and you see how far we've come from then until now, where now if you have a blowout, that is a huge, huge deal. Back then, you had a blowout. They were dancing around and celebrating it. you know, it's a big difference. It's a big change. I think there's also a point to be made about renewable sources of energy that are coming online now. It took a long, long time for the oil and gas industry to permeate our society to the extent that it has, to get to the point where we could use every molecule that's in a barrel of oil. It took a long time to develop those processes. And I think that that's an important point to take into account when we're looking at new fuels that are coming on, new additional energy sources that are coming along, is it's not going to be a light switch that you can just flip and go from one to the other, because the technology is not there for any other source to be able to replace oil at this point in time in our history. And we have to understand that, and I think that's part of that logical conversation of where does oil and gas fit in our present and in our future really comes in.
Warren Martin with Kansas Strong, thank you very much for the time today.
Oh, thank you, sir.